Hello, Indigenous Earthlings. Here we are again, seven revolutions later, balancing into another Express Yourself. I'm Luke Nessler, and that was Chain Station with a tune called No Contest. Well, it's a slam dunk no contest as Chain Station brings their bluegrass newgrass to Steve's guitars tonight. And right here and right now, the modern metal wizard responsible for a butane and oxygen-powered dart gun, a gas-powered tick plucker, say that three times real fast, and a mechanical stainless steel chastity belt that is menacing and elegant at the same time. Joins Express Yourself first today, Ira Sherman. Welcome to KD&K.
Thank you for being. Glad I'm here.
So you have to tell me what these chastity belts are all about. Describe it first.
Well, I think you got to go a little bit into my background as a jeweler. I'm a professional jeweler, been a jeweler for 40 years, and I make elegant, beautiful, wearable art. I'm also a sculptor who works in stainless steel and steel, and I do a lot of welding and forging and blacksmithing. And I combined the two together with a little bit of intuitive gonzo mechanical engineering and put together these mechanical, plausible reality-type sculptures you wear, such as a pneumatic chastity belt, for instance.
Seussian. They look like straight out of Dr. Seuss, almost.
Well, I hope they're more formal and more elegant, and certainly more structurally durable. Uh-huh. You know, uh-huh. There's a collection that the reason I'm here in Carbondale is I'm participating in Green is New Black fashion extravaganza that's going to open tonight. Actually, I'm one of the many lines of designers who are doing fashions. My work is steel, and it's forged out steel, and my line of fashion is called Chastity Couture. This show is actually, it's quite elegant, beautiful, kind of funny when you see the work, because it's very sexy and very dramatic. At the same time, it has some very serious roots, which started back in 2000 when I interviewed friends and family members that actually had been assaulted and raped, and they asked me, why don't you do a show of artwork based on what we'd like to see happen to the rapist? So I did a exhibition that actually opened at the Metals Museum in Memphis, Tennessee in 2006, I believe. And these were very beautiful, beautiful stainless steel, medically precise looking instruments you wear on your body. And the show is actually quite successful, with a little bit of flack from some conservative groups out there.
Of course.
It was good. You know, all publicity is good publicity, the way I look at it.
Right.
From that, I had a hard time booking the show. A few universities took the show. But it's not a nice topic. And people don't talk about rape and sexual abuse and incest as a common, happy, let's come to our art gallery and get it funded and present this guy. So I had an idea a while back to tone it down from its from these mechanized machines that do horrible things, you know, as a revenge or as protection, to these elegant, beautiful, traditional chastity belts. Something that doesn't allow anybody to have access unless they have the key. So in my show, the women have the key. And in my show, the pieces are truly elegant and beautiful and incredibly sexy. And when my models go down the runway, it's really a wonderful, very beautiful experience. Yet they're wearing these fashions that you can't possibly get into. You know,
and they're positively menacing, and they will do serious damage to any intruder.
No, not these. These are different.
Oh,
that's,
okay.
That's the show that was in Memphis. Those were the menacing ones. These strictly are barriers. Very beautiful, sexy berries. When someone gets attacked, the first thing, what do they do when there's prosecution? They say, well, you asked for it. You look too sexy. You're in the wrong place at the wrong time, blah, blah, blah. So I allow the person to look just as beautiful and as sexy as they want, but nothing's going to happen.
Nice. You know? Well, I can just imagine in the context of the fashion show, something like that, I'm sure they're going to be huge hits.
I hope so, and I think the whole show is going to be a huge hit. I saw parts of it. Usually we're backstage, so I don't see a lot of it. But the show is called She. It's based on women's experiences, and it's put together by Amy Kimberly and Laura Stover, who are truly professional in what they do. And I've been watching them work. I was here last year for the show and participated, and I watched them this year. And they put on a very fine, very well-organized and well-presented show. And it'll all be well-received. You guys are lucky to have this.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. So your part of the show, your work, will also be shown at the distillery, right?
Right. Sunday? What we're going to do, and we did this last year, is after the show is over, I'm going to have what's called an artist salon session. I'll bring the pieces that were in the show down. We're going to set them up. I'll be there to talk about them. You can actually touch them and see them and really examine the metalsmithing skills in them. There's some jewelry techniques there. You can when you see them off the body, they're even more powerful, believe it or not. Yeah. At least from this artist's opinion, I do it as an exoskeletal sculptural experience. So you walk around this thing and you see through it, and you see how patterns interface and the contrast of the metal, and then you can touch it and see how heavy and structural these things are.
There's an element of humor in what you do, isn't there?
There's some level of humor. Because the topic is so serious, you gotta laugh. I mean, yeah. You gotta deal with it somehow. I think when you see the work off the body, there won't be any humor. There's gonna just be you might be awed a little bit. You might say, "What? How? Woo? You know, how do you do this? Where's this going? This fits on the body? How?" You know, then comes the plausible reality of the piece, and then you will see some pictures of it, you know, on the runway.
Uh-huh. Well, if people visit irasherman.com, they might have a better idea of what's in store for what they're going to see. But it's worth checking out. Some of those videos are fairly humorous.
Well, then there's the humorous side. You know, it's the banana chopping anti-rape device and the one that basically shoots stainless steel darts at the intruder, you know, those type of pieces. They do such horrible things, it's hysterical. You know, and if you put them in certain contexts, you know, replace the biological anatomy with a banana, and all of a sudden things take on a bit of humor. You know?
And there's, at least in one of the initial iterations of this work, you injected an attacker with tattoo dye?
Well, I designed a piece
to do that.
The people who I interviewed, to my surprise, I thought he was going to say, "We want the guy's, you know, genitals chopped off," or something like that. And almost everybody said they want the attacker identified and apprehended. That was the main thing that everybody, the few people I interviewed, that's what they all said. So I did a little research, and I figured, you know, let's do a piece that injects tattoo dye and a sedative. So this is a very medical-looking instrument. It has two syringes. The syringes are activated by high-pressure air. So, you know, one circuit injects the needles. The other circuit squeezes the juice out, so to speak, and the person's identified and apprehended.
Well, Ira Sherman, I get the sense that I could talk with you for hours. Unfortunately, we don't have hours, but we've agreed that we'll be chatting on this show again sometime in August.
Yeah, I'd love to come back. Actually, I come back every August to attend the Whitaker workshops, the RMS blacksmith workshops here in Carbondale.
Oh, great.
Very high quality blacksmithing, and I'll be back. Yeah. That's my hobby, by the way.
So we'll talk to you then, huh?
I hope so.
All right. Great, that's thanks. Great. Well, Ira Sherman here on KDNK, and his work appearing at the fashion show. Opening night is tonight. That show, of course, is sold out, as is tomorrow's show. But as you heard, you can see some of Ira's work over at Marble Distillery. What time does that start?
It's going to be from 3:30 to 6. We may have some models. We'll see. Sometimes the models volunteer and come down. So most of the pieces won't be on a model, but we might have some models also.
Ira, thank you so much for joining the show.
You're most welcome. Great to be here.
Stay tuned. Noam Pikelny is up next on today's Express Yourself. Thank you. Noam Pikelny with a brand new song called Waveland from his brand new CD called Universal Favorite. Noam Pikelny, welcome to KD&K.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. That I think that's about as close as a banjo gets to a harp, and I don't mean the mouth harp.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah, I guess it is kind of that kind of repetitive, the trill pattern on there. You know, that song, it started with a lot less notes. It started just as a simple kind of music boxy lullaby. And that's kind of what I had for a few years, and then I started playing around with that pattern. And it kind of took on a life of its own.
Waveland. I know you're from Illinois. Are you a Chicago Cubs fan?
I am. The Waveland is a direct reference to the Chicago Cubs. Waveland being the street behind the left-wheeled wall of Wrigley Field, and the sessions for this album, Universal Favorite, actually coincidentally were scheduled to start the same day as Game 7 of the World Series this last year, and I just couldn't believe it. After all of this, this is a project I've been looking forward to making forever, and the idea of the Cubs being in the World Series, let alone making it to Game 7, just seemed unfathomable. And there I started staring down the calendar, saying, oh boy, the first day I'm going to be in the studio is the day the Cubs are going to be in Game 7. And we thought, oh, well, maybe we'll go in after the game and we'll start recording. And then the game gets into, you know, a rain delay and extra innings, and we ended up burning the entire first day of the studio. We didn't even show our faces. But we started the next morning with a Cubs World Series victory.
You must have been super stoked. What a great way to start.
It was, yeah. It was the album was the recording sessions were flanked by the Cubs winning the World Series in a fairly momentous election the day after we finished. So it was kind of crazy times.
Yes, it was. How about that? Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned the word lullaby, because that song sounds like a fairy tale. So let's call it The Day Hell Froze Over.
Yeah, that's pretty much. I can pretty much agree with that. Yeah, it's like, you know, the Cubs winning the World Series is almost seems like an apocalyptic event, and so this show that I'm doing, the solo banjo show, in some ways it's essentially the same set of music I'd be playing if I was the only musician standing on Earth. And so it's a kind of a dystopian concept show inspired by a Cubs World Series win.
How about that? Well, that explains the cover photo then. You alone on a little island in a lake with two trees.
That's right.
How about that?
Yeah.
So on the desert island, you're going to have your banjo.
That's probably, you know, you might be able to burn a guitar for more warmth than a banjo, because a guitar has more wood. But you know, I feel the heavy metal aspect of the banjo, it could be used as a weapon if necessary.
Wow, I don't think I've ever heard the phrase banjo and heavy metal used together. But
it's literally a heavy metal instrument. Textbook heavy metal.
That's really funny. You know, I'm struck by your sense of humor here and now, but I also watched your making of this new CD, and I laughed out loud several times.
Oh, thank you.
That was really funny. And I was struck by the deadpan humor. Did you write that movie and film it yourself?
I came up with the idea myself and wrote a bunch of it, and then brought in a friend of mine who lives in L.A., who's an amazing actor and writer and improviser, a guy named Greg Hess, who's with a troupe called the Improvised Shakespeare Group. They're just kind of astonishingly brilliant improvising troupe. And so I've known Greg for a few years, and I had this idea and kind of a general sketch of it, and he came in and kind of helped shepherd it along the thing into full form.
It's really funny. Really funny. I'm really happy that you posted it on your website.
Oh,
because people pleasure, need yeah. to see it, especially your fans. It's pretty hilarious. And I was, as I said, struck by sort of the deadpan humor of it. But you use the word, maybe it's not you, but your music on your website, which is noampikelny.com, by the way. Pikelny, P-I-K-E-L-N-Y.
And we also have a new device. You could just go to noam.net. It's a lot easier to spell, N-O-A-M.net.
Nice. Yeah. Anyway, it's up there. But you described the new CD on there as, oh, I think it was describing your voice, deadpan baritone.
Oh, I guess, yeah, someone wrote that and it ended up on there. But I guess that's a fair description. You know, I haven't Most people don't know me first and foremost as a singer. Obviously, I've spent most of my life playing banjo and much larger ensembles with lots of seasoned vocalists. And as I was gathering the material for this project, it initially was conceived as an opportunity to kind of showcase some of the detail of a banjo that just doesn't translate in a larger band setting. The banjo can be warm, the banjo can have sustain, it can do all these things that don't necessarily come across when you have four or five instruments on stage. And so that was some of the original motivation. But as I started gathering the material, I realized, you know, I don't want this to be a banjo recital. Like this, I don't want it to be purely instrumental. And playing vocal music is such a huge part of my musical identity. And I love backing up singers, and I love playing to serve a song, to support the song. And I thought, you know what, I need to bring in some songs, and I'm not going to shy away from it just because I haven't spent the main focus of my career being a singer.
Several songs have your voice on it, and that's the first time in, what, this is your fourth solo?
This is the fourth solo album, and the first time I've sung on any of them, yeah.
Huh. And well, a lot of our listeners may know you, may remember you from Leftover Salmon.
Absolutely.
Back in the day.
Yeah,
so you have Colorado roots.
Absolutely. Colorado was, instrumental as far as my musical career. I left Champaign, Illinois, which is just about 3 hours south of Chicago. I was going to school in Champaign, and I had two semesters left before graduating. And I got lured away by Vince and Drew and Leftover Salmon, and they offered me this gig where I moved to Colorado, and before I knew it, I was touring the country with a national band. And that was my foot in the door. That was my first experience really playing professionally on the national level, and having the experience of being around those guys and seeing the community that they built and just this incredible spirit behind everything that they did. I think it was really a profound thing to witness at that stage of my career. And I still haven't witnessed someone who could command an audience like Vince Herman.
Yeah.
He's
Falstaffian.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yes.
It's amazing.
It is.
I was blown away by it back then. I'm still blown away by that. And I've always, tried to reference, the way he kind of creates and cultivates a community. And so coming back to Colorado feels like a little bit of a homecoming, and that it was this, this music community throughout the Front Range and up in the mountains here in Telluride that really kind of offered the first kind of real embrace and made me feel welcome as far as being a professional musician. And so it's just kind of indispensable, the experience I had out here.
Was it on that national tour with Leftover that you met Chris Thiele and Gabe Witcher and
it
all
was,
those guys?
It was a little bit longer. It was a little bit of a winding path. Through Leftover Salmon, I my first time playing at the Telluride Bluegrass Festival was with Leftover Salmon, and so I got to meet a lot of those kind of acoustic music superheroes at that festival. And eventually I started playing with John Cowan, and who was a regular collaborator with Leftover Salmon, and started playing with John Cowan, and that brought me back to the Telluride Bluegrass Festival as well. And it was backstage at the Sheridan Opera House that I got in a jam session with Chris Thiele, and from that session we started figuring out, trying to find an opportunity to play more music together. And then all of a sudden he came along with this idea for Punch Brothers. So many of the roots of these projects are based in Colorado. So it's sweet to be back.
So Punch Brothers, your main gig, but you're not shy on touring on this new solo album. You're playing 23 dates in 31 days this month.
Yeah, it's a busy 5-week tour once it's all said and done. The record Universal Favorite came out on March 3rd, and we started in Seattle and on March 1st, and we'll be finishing in Savannah, Georgia Savannah and then Nashville. We keep adding dates, but it's over 5 weeks and kind of going to most places in the country. There's a few that we'll have to come back this fall to visit, but it's a one-man show, which means it's logistically it's a lot easier to go somewhere when you're not having to deal with five people's schedules or 20 instruments and all the gear that goes along with it. So it's very portable, and I could play in someone's backyard if they need me to. But it's something I really enjoy. I get a chance to play a lot of this new music and tell some stories on stage and just kind of hold court in a way that I would never subject any of my fellow musicians to if they were standing beside me.
So a solo show on a stage, that's probably good that you had a teacher like Vince Herrmann.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, that's I really enjoy getting to interact with the audience, and I think the first time I really saw how that's done masterfully was through was from Vince. And huh. So huh. If we could all strive to be able to carry a show like Vince.
Indeed. Well, your tour brings you to the Wheeler Opera House. Have you played the Wheeler before?
Yeah, I've played there with Punch Brothers. It's been probably 4 years or so. And then before that, was there with John Cowan in Leftover Salmon. So it's been a regular performance, you know, every 3 or 4 years. But it's been a while, so I'm psyched to be back.
That show's tonight over at the Wheeler. Noam, I'd love to hear another tune from you.
Sure. I'll play one more song off the album. This one also has some Chicago roots. This was a song I first learned when I was about 9 years old. This song was actually the very first track on the very first album I ever owned. I went to a record store with my dad, and we bought a record by a Chicago folk singer named Fleming Brown, and his record was called The Little Rosewood Casket and Other Songs of Joy, which I still think is the greatest album title ever. And this song was track one on side A. It's called Once I Had an Old Banjo. Once I had an old banjo, it was strung with twine. The only song that I could sing was Trouble on My Mind. Boys, trouble on my mind. Trouble on my mind. Boys, trouble on my mind. I went down to Lynchburg to fetch me a bottle of wine. They hitched me to that whipping post. They gave me 99. Boys gave me 99. Gave me 99. Boys gave me 99. Back to Lynchburg to fetch me a bottle of gin. They hitched me to that whipping post. They gave me hell again. Boys gave me hell again. Gave me hell again. Boys gave me hell again. Strung with twine, the only song that I could sing was Trouble on My Mind. Boys, trouble on my mind. Trouble on my mind. Boys, trouble on my mind. Trouble on my mind. Boys, trouble on my mind. Boys,
That's Noam Pikelny live at KDNK. I'm playing tonight at the Wheeler Opera House. You heard any good banjo jokes lately, Noam?
Oh, man, it's been a while. I'm trying to think of what was the last good banjo joke I've heard. Boy, it probably goes back a few years. So it's not recent, but I always love the one. What do you say to a banjo player in a 3-piece suit? Will the defendant please rise?
I don't know what it is about banjo, but it brings out those jokes, doesn't yeah. it? Hey, Noam, we're in the middle of our membership drive at KDNK, and I'm sort of guessing that community radio around the country has provided a ready audience for what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. It became pretty clear when I started doing this for a living that my, you know, abstract solo banjo instrumental music wasn't going to make it onto the top 40 charts on commercial radio. And so as a musician making a career performing music, recording music, and traveling around the country, I don't know how it would be possible to do it without community radio and public radio. It's really one of the few areas where we can reach listeners and offer our music without any kind of commercial considerations, and it could just be about the music and about the stories that artists have to tell. So that's something that's indispensable as someone doing this professionally, but as somebody who grew up in Chicago, who is a kind of a vociferous listener of public radio and community radio, I'm not sure I'd be doing this right now if I wasn't exposed to music and introduced to musicians through radio. I listen to a local station called WDCB every Wednesday night for the Strictly Bluegrass show, and it was through that show I first heard Alison Krauss, and 2 years later I won tickets to see Alison Krauss in person through that show. And WBEZ Radio in Chicago, the big NPR station, they hosted or sponsored the first Bela Fleck and the Flecktones concert I went to. And the host of that show arranged for a meeting between the 9-year-old me and Bela Fleck at the time.
Wow.
And so, like, I can't imagine how those connections would have been made if it wasn't for those stations and those people and the listenership. And so it's something I continue to support personally and always advocate other people to pony up for.
Well said, sir. Thank you so much for that.
My pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
That's Noam Pikelny, and wasn't that a heck of a testimony? Thanks, Noam. Nice guy and great musician playing at the Wheeler tonight. Well, stay with us. Rodney Crowell up next.
So I grew up hungry and I grew up high. Took the streets and alleys by my own backyard. I got a breaking in it on my list of crimes. Been before the judge one too many times. East Houston blues, scale of 1 to 10, about a 9.5. It's where it's always been. It's in the drinking water and in a bar ditch mud. East Houston blues, it's in the poor boy's blood. I learned to drink and drive when I was 12 years old. My Uncle Fireball started, rest his ragged soul. He run a 54-foot up and down the drag, sipping early ties straight from a paper bag. East Houston blues, pictured Dowling Street and Navigation Boulevard, where the crossroads meet. Three sheets in the wind, rickshaw load. East Houston blues, down a nowhere road. Thank you. Jack Bangora hat. Stolen money from an inside job. Maybe think about that. I'm a third world child. My mother's only son, which means exactly nothing without a loaded gun. I don't believe in love, this I guarantee. If there's a God above, he's got it in for me. East Houston blues, what you want me to say? I need to find me a woman, keep the wolves at bay. Keep my head on straight, maybe toe the line. East Houston blues ain't no friend of mine. So you understand that of which I speak. I'm a worried man on a losing streak.
Houston Blues from Rodney Crowell's brand new CD, Close Ties. What Do Till I Gain Control Again and Shame on the Moon have in common? Well, besides being great songs, they were both written by Rodney Crowell. Since Rodney Crowell arrived in Nashville in the early 70s, he has carved out not only a notable songwriting career, but also a stellar performing and recording career. With 15 solo albums to his credit and collaborations with folks like Emmylou Harris and Mary Carr, Rodney is a true force in Americana music. And next Tuesday, Rodney comes to our Fair Valley, bringing a trio to the stage of the Wheeler Opera House. I spoke to Rodney yesterday before he leaves on his three-date swing through Colorado. Joining Express Yourself now is Rodney Crowell. Welcome, Rodney.
Hey there. How are you, Luke?
I'm pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm good. You know, it's a beautiful day. I'm in Tennessee, and it's a nice day here. I'm looking out the window, sitting in my studio, looking out the window, talking to you. How may I be of service?
Well, I want to know all about your new CD. It's your 15th solo album. It's set to drop at the end of the month. And its charms have released themselves slowly to me. The first time I listened to it in the truck driving down to Grand Junction to my mother's house. And that was the wrong way to listen to that CD, I realized, because the second time I listened to it, I was in a quiet room and I was following the words to the songs. And that's where it became apparent that this is a very accomplished CD. Are you happy with it?
Yeah, I am. And I'm glad that the language found you, because I do spend a lot of time making sure that I get the narrative and the language right. I'm kind of obsessed with that. But, you know, also the music, the energy of the music should translate in a rattly truck going downhill, too. So try it again going down the hill now that you have it.
Well, there were a couple of
what I'm talking about.
There were a couple of roadworthy tunes on there, you know, where you're tapping your foot for sure going down the road. But there are some quieter songs in there. And I think that the assuredness that I heard on that second listen is, as I said, it's music made for the rocking chair, isn't it?
Well, okay, I'll go with that. I mean, the image of the rocking chair, as long as that suggests a repose rather than retired,
yes.
Because, you know, every artist, you know, no matter what state you are in your in your process and where you are in the course of your career, it's like, you know, relevance is of importance. You know, it's like the work should be relevant. And I don't want it to just be relevant to the rocking chair. I want it to be relevant to the washing machine when that's going around the house too.
So,
but then again, it's on me that the subject matter is that I choose and the way I want to express myself and the freedom I have at this point in my career to explore anything that I want to, I do ask quite a bit of the audience in terms of, well, you're going to have to pay attention to this because I'm not going to make this particularly easy for you.
Huh. So you say you spend a lot of time on those lyrics, and it shows. There's not a wasted word. In that way, it kind of reminds me of Hank Williams.
Hank Williams, that's high praise. Hank Williams came along, you know, in just in the post-war culture, you know, in 1947, when, you know, when the war was over and there was a celebration going on, you know, young people were going into the honky-tonks and drinking beer and girls were kicking their shoes off and jitterbugging and dancing, and Hank Williams found a narrative that fit that freedom and that rejuvenation that was going on then. His music really spoke to that, but he also did it with heartbreak, you know, like with cold, cold heart and your cheating heart and no one will ever know. Hank Williams never shied away from the heartache and the pain and the sorrow. But he also brought joy, you know, like in, with Hey Good Looking, My Bucket's Got a Hole in It. So I, being a big fan of Hank Williams, I take that as high praise.
Well, you're so welcome. And I guess your dad took you to a Hank Williams concert when you were just a toddler, didn't he?
Yeah, it was 2 years and 4 months and a week. Hank Williams' next to last performance in Houston, Texas, 1952. My dad put me on his shoulders, and I wrote about it in my memoir, Chinaberry Sidewalks. And I do have a memory of the smell of my dad's hair tonic, and I do have a memory of a cool breeze wafting down from overhead and kind of the low-end sound of the audience happening. But that memory was reinforced over and over and over by my father growing up, because he really liked to drive home to me. I took you to see Hank Williams. This is part of my legacy for you. He never encouraged me to be a songwriter or a musician, but he encouraged me to understand what he had done and how he was proud of himself for having done that.
Well, you say somewhere, and it might have been in Chinaberry Sidewalks, and I want to talk about that in a little bit because it's a great memoir, but somewhere I picked up that you said, my dad made it my dream to be up on that stage. So the seed was planted early.
Yeah, I might be a slight misinterpretation of what it was. It's like my dad dreamed of being up on that stage.
Oh, okay.
And that was his dream, and I think my dream was, in the beginning, the tone that I was following was, how do I write songs? How do you do that? And over the course of longing or desiring to write songs, I was led, you know, by providence into a scenario in the early 70s in Nashville where Towns Van Zandt and I had access to Towns Van Zandt and Guy Clark and Mickey Newberry and Harlan Howard, professional songwriters, where when I was at that formative stage in my career where I could listen and learn and observe and absorb and intuitively continue on the path that brought me to Nashville in the first place. So in that sense, And I wound up on a stage. I have to thank Emmy Lou Harris for that. She's the one that put me on a stage. I didn't have any design, and I don't even think I had much ambition other than, how do you write songs? How does that happen? Because I'm a naturally born songwriter. This I know. Well, and over the years, I've become a very good singer. That I can say. I wasn't an accomplished singer in the beginning, but with hard work and dedication and lots of thought and practice, I've become a good singer.
Well, you wrote a song on your new CD, Nashville 1972, and you mentioned several names. You also have a song on there, Life Without Susanna, one of the people that you mm-hmm. met in the early 70s in Nashville. And on your website, you say this of Susanna Clark. She was married to the songwriter Guy Clark, who became a very close friend when I was in my early 20s. We weren't lovers, and in fact, she offered me more than that. She was this incredibly intelligent, creative woman and my first ever muse. In my quest to please her artistically, I became a realized songwriter. That sounds like quite a dynamic. Tell me about that.
Well, I was very articulate at that moment because that's all very true. Susanna changed my life, as did Guy. But Guy, over a long period of time, Susanna very quickly, because until I met Susanna, I hadn't really formed friendships with women. You know, as a young man, you know, in my 19, 20, and 21 years old, the conquest was the only thing that I understood about the opposite sex. And then when I met Susanna, who was, you know, 10 and a half years older than me, and a very compelling character, a poet and a painter and an artist and a wise woman, she taught me how to be friends with a woman. And since then, you know, I've had a string of great friendships with, you know, Emmylou Harris and Mary Carr and Dixie Gamble and Joanne Gardner and my four daughters and Roseanne Cash, and it continues on. And that, I think over the years, I have learned so much from women. You know, the conversation with women are quite different than the conversations among men. In fact, Susanna used to really chide us all about, you know, how competitive we were with each other, you know, us fellas. You know, it wasn't bloodthirsty competitiveness, but, you know, you wanted to be able to write a song to raise her eyebrow, you know, of course, Townsend's Aunt was setting the bar all the way across the board, and to aim for that bar and even come under it was a pretty good accomplishment. So, and you mentioned Life Without Susanna, the song. It's like, sadly, Susanna succumbed to agoraphobia and spent the last 10 years of her life shut away. And it was a long, slow passing. And during that time, I was very frustrated and very angry and very hurt that she withdrew. And to have a relationship with her, you had to go and sit bedside with her, and I fought it tooth and nail. I cursed it. I tried to trick her. I did everything I could, and in the end, I had to surrender because her will to withdraw was stronger than my will to bring her out. And when she passed away, I could have written a broad stroke love song about this great woman that I knew, or I could write a true love song and express my anger and the sorrow and the hurt and my own frustration with myself because I was judgmental and at times not supportive. And so I believe that Life Without Susanna, that particular recording, is as true a song as I could write. And you know, it was on the level that lifelong friendship was. So there, I've said that.
Well, it's a remarkably honest song with a lot of remarkably honest sentiments. But, you know, it's not confined to that song. Another good example of that is It Ain't Over Yet. I guess that's the first single to the album. And it's also on a video on your website, RodneyCrawl.com. Great video, by the way, featuring Roseanne Cash and John Paul White. But, you know, there's a remarkably clear-eyed optimism in the record, even though you're talking some hard truths. That, you know, I feel a lot of bemusement despite all the hard-won wisdom. You know, it's like it happened. There it is. It made me who I am. What's up next?
Yeah. Well, there again, that was the album is called Close Ties, and it is, you know, people that have meant a lot to me were dropping off the planet. And so it ain't over yet. I wrote that song over a period of as Guy Clark was making his transition out of this physical world into wherever, whatever's next. And so writing that song, it became a narrative. It became a three-way conversation. One is the older male, and the choruses were the younger male. So I took the older male narrative, and John Paul White performs the younger male narrative, you know, which is, it ain't over yet, you know, what you want to bet, one more cigarette ain't going to kill you, that kind of thing. And then there's a third voice in it of Roseanne Cash's, which Roseanne Cash took that third part. But that narrative was based on what I've already mentioned, that Susanna used to say to us boys, you know, you silly boys, you know, she called us silly boys, even though we were grown men. And it was very, only a wise woman, you know, that you're a silly boy, you're so competitive, and you think this is about impressing, you know, the thing about being an artist is to impress, you know, it's not about that, it's to show people who they are. Stop that. So that the Roseanne part in that song is certainly Susanna Clark narrative. Huh. So I have written quite a bit about the importance of those two relationships in my life. But I also explore my relationship with my wife, Claudia, from the perspective of what it might be like in the future if we weren't, you know, if one of us were to leave the other to go on to wherever we go next, and in the form of a song called 40 Miles from Nowhere, which is at the bottom of the world, let's say. And that song, and that's where I say, you know, for the audience that pays attention to what I do, it's I'm going to take you there, but I always have in mind the redemption. You know, the going down the dark alley is one thing, but to go down the dark alley without some form of redemption in the narrative, I don't feel that I've done my job. So I spend a lot of time working on really delivering the redemption that human beings need when loss happens.
I think that might be the center of the album, at least in the second listening of it for me, 40 Miles from Nowhere. You know, the one line that really jumped out at me, 100 billion points of light to guide my way back home. That's an optimistic scenario.
Well, you know, that's those November skies. You're up in the mountains there. I mean, all those clear nights, and there's a diamond-studded dome up there. That's a vision that, you know, we all can share, all of us who have, you know, looked at wonder at the night sky. And there is some kind of guiding factor, that some guiding light that comes from on high, you know, whatever your beliefs, you know, spiritual beliefs about it. You know, I've been around long enough to know that the opinions on that are so varied that to get too specific about it is to invite ridicule and criticism. But on the other hand, it is something we all share.
Yeah, yeah. There's one other song I want to talk about on the album, and that's the first one. And it's one of those songs that worked as I was driving, and that's East Houston Blues, a blues tune from Rodney Crowell. Part on your website, I think you shout out Howlin' Wolf and Lightnin' Hopkins, partly because they're from Houston, right?
Howlin' Wolf is not from Houston.
Oh, but Lightnin' is.
Yeah, Lightnin's from Fifth Ward, and I brag that I'm from Third Ward, Houston. Fifth Ward is, you know, where Lightnin' set up shop. Listen, here's the thing. You know, when I came on as a young man, Hank Williams was the bar for what the blues was, and it was a form of country blues. But, you know, all the Delta blues guys and Lightning, who picked up, you know, his form of blues from the Delta, that was a form of country music, too. It's well, we call it the country blues, you know. And for my career, career is not a good word, just for my education and how to play and sing, I came from the Hank Williams school. And then a few years ago, it dawned on me, I said, I need to do a real study and exploration of the traditional blues coming from Robert Johnson, Charlie Patton, and, you know, Muddy Waters and R.L. Burnside and those Mississippi through Chicago heritage. You know, in Chicago it became more electrified, but, you know, down on the plantation it was acoustic. And I started looking into that music and collecting it and absorbing it and learning the guitar, to approach the guitar somewhere in that vein or that genre. And lo and behold, I started to write songs where the study and the time I'd spent with the guitar started to yield original compositions. And East Houston Blues is one that came from that, as is I Don't Care Anymore. And since then, I've continued to explore. And one of the thoughts that I had, here's the thing that dawned on me. I thought about it. I really admire the Rolling Stones. And I admire a lot of those English guys, Eric Clapton. You know, I was thinking, wow, those guys were really into Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and the blues. And when they started writing their own kind of songs, you know, Honky Tonk Women and Brown Sugar, or, you know, Billy Gibbons and ZZ Top, you know, it's like Billy stayed really close to the lowdown, you know, B.B. King kind of blues. But the other guys, you know, started writing pop songs, but at the beneath it, there was the kind of gravitas of the blues man. And I started saying, I want some of that gravitas. I need to bring some of that gravitas. I'm not a black man. I'm not going to sing with that kind of conviction and that off the cuff thing that Lightning Hopkins has, but somewhere down inside of me there is a blues man, and it's a true one. It's just a blue-eyed white boy, you know, who's grown up and is looking in the right corner now to find a way to continue on. And that's how the blues has come into my field of vision.
Well, I can't remember who it was that said blues is a feeling, and, you know, white people have feelings too.
Yeah. We have sorrow. We have unpaid bills.
Yeah. Hey, be sure to visit kdnk.org after this show, and I'll have the entire conversation with Rodney posted.